Welcome back to Screen Crush Rewind. I'm your host, Ryan Airy, and today we are talking about House of the Dragon Season 3, Episode 2. Did we like it? Did we hate it? Was it mediocre? Do we want more fights? We're going to get to the bottom of all of that today. And as always, guys, keep your comments coming. We got a great one already. I can't wait to address from Sim Vanderbrink, which brings up a good point. And Super Chats are always encouraged, but not required. I want to quickly say that here on Screen Crush Rewind, we have a massive week coming up. We got to talk about Supergirl. We almost talked about that today, but we're going to talk about Supergirl tomorrow. We are going to be talking about some big Marvel news that has dropped throughout the week on Wednesday, and then probably more Marvel news after that. It seems like everything is happening in July. So I cannot wait to talk to you guys about this and talk to our rotating panel of guests who I should start bringing on right now. First of all, I'm so happy to have her on. The person who wrote our House of the Dragon breakdowns, including our exceptional breakdown we posted last night, is Harriet Lingle Enright. What's going on, Harriet?
Hey, I'm so excited to talk about this episode.
Me too. I don't want to spoil if I'm excited because I hated it or loved it. We'll have to save that for later, but I'm excited to get everybody else on. And of course, we have friend of the channel, co-host of the Comic Book Club podcast, the guy who's always on hold, Mr. Alex Galvin. What's going on, Alex?
Sorry. I'm on with Otto Hightower's people, and it keeps going. I don't know. I've been on hold for a really long time. They keep being like, hey, hang on. Don't lose your head. I don't know what that means. I'll put the phone down for now.
And that's a good time to acknowledge spoiler warning for all things House of the Dragon. Whoops. Season 3. Oh, gosh. They're going to come get me in the comments. And finally, former congressional candidate and intern we fire at the end of every video, Mr. Cameron Caskey. What's going on, Cam?
I'm just excited to talk about this. I happen to be more excited to talk about this one than I was about last week's.
Yeah, I am too. And I wanted to specifically bring you guys on. I know not everybody watching this watched our video last week, because you guys had legit complaints about the first episode last week. And Cameron, you reshaped my brain when I didn't realize this, that they originally intended to end season 2 at the Battle of the Gauntlet, but because of strikes and other Hollywood things, they had to put it here. And I do think the first episode would have been a much better capper to that season. You know, usually in Game of Thrones, we're used to the penultimate episode having a big fight or a big event, death of Ned Stark, and the following episode being fallout. And I kind of feel like the first two episodes of this season feel like they should have been at the end of season 2. I want to start off by just hearing what you guys thought. And again, let us know in the comments. Let's just go around the table. Harriet, go right ahead. What'd you think?
I think this is one of my favorite episodes of the show, period. I think it's just fantastic. There's like almost nothing about it that I would change. I think it's honestly, I like where it is in the season because I think having this happen in episode 2 of a season really leads us up to like, especially for people who have not read the book, of like, where is it going to go from here?
Mm-hmm. Alex.
Sure. Couldn't agree more. This was thrilling. I mean, I'd go farther to say like, this is one of the best episodes in the Game of Thrones franchise, particularly like it sets up all the pieces so neatly in the first half hour and then everything in the second half hour. I mean, I admitted the last time I haven't read Fire and Blood specifically, but not knowing where it was going, watching everything that's going on, I was like, this is going to go wrong. This is going to go wrong at any second. This cannot be happening. They cannot just be, one does not simply walk into King's Landing like that. And then it happens. And obviously it does. Horrific things happen right at the end of the episode, but they're horrific emotional things. And I think that's what worked so well about this episode for me versus the previous episode is we had the bombast, but not necessarily for me as a viewer, the emotional stakes. Here, it wasn't that this was a quiet episode necessarily, but the things that were happening were so based in the emotion of the characters and the actors, particularly Emma D'Arcy, which this is like... Emmy all over it. Like, this clinched the Emmy, this episode, from the first scene to the last scene. Just absolutely incredible work. I was goosebumped all over the entire time.
Yeah, and Harriet, after Cameron talks, you had some great points in the Easter egg video about her acting. I can't wait for you to tell everybody. But Cam, what did you think of the episode?
It's like, it was just such a phenomenal finale to season 2. moment when Emma, again, it's just such an extraordinary performer. When Emma just looks forward at what Rhaenyra has done in... We're past spoiled territory, right?
Yes, I would hope.
Spoilers, everybody. Spoilers.
We're definitely past spoilers.
I spoiled it in my intro.
Rhaenyra's look at the end of the episode, sitting on the Iron Throne, and just that look of at what cost, where Rhaenyra is finally getting what Rhaenyra has wanted for so long, and immediately starts questioning, but was it worth all of this? It was just so good. And, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of House of the Dragon. I have so many issues with it, but it's just hard to deny that this episode was just pretty riveting top to bottom. I mean, you know, with last week, we had so much of the episode going to these scenes that existed to contextualize the season, because it's been 2 years since we've watched it. And I think a lot of the scenes in the first half of the last episode were just such a drag and not memorable, and in my opinion, a little annoying. This whole episode, I mean, every minute, every character is just chewing up the screen. Aegon's scene especially was just a testament to what a performance Tom Glenn Carney is giving, and how he's doing so much with so little. Like, Aegon does not have that much screen time for a character so memorable. But
in House of the Dragon and Fire and Blood, not that, you know, he's not like a, you know, central, you don't see him for a long time. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. So there's obviously a lot of differences. I've said this before, like, I don't really care when there are differences from the source material, as long as those consolidations are being made to improve the story, or if they're necessary consolidations. Some battles are going to need to happen off screen. That's just the thing. Interesting tidbit, in Fire and Blood, Gawain Hightower, the character that we see hanging out with Kristen Cole, waxing poetically a lot, he was actually killed when Rhaenyra took King's Landing. He was in King's Landing and was stabbed after calling one of the Gold Cloaks a traitor. But they moved the character over to give someone for Kristen Cole to talk to. I thought it was great. I really thought Emma D'Arcy's performance was just extraordinary. And I'm excited for the first episode of season three.
Yeah. Harry, just I want to circle back to touch on the acting choices she made, Emma D'Arcy, and the final scene there that you addressed in her Easter egg video.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I think this performance from Emma D'Arcy, I think like it's a incredible, incredible performance. And seeing that those last few minutes, I mean, plus the opening scene with them with Jace's death is incredible. I was watching it last night with some friends, and everyone was silent during that scene because it was so like heart-wrenching. But that final moment
when she's yelling at his corpse, what have you done? And you think she's yelling at the people in the room. Yeah, it's incredible.
But that those final moments, the way Rhaenyra finally hardens to like taking this violent action. I mean, I've seen a lot of complaints that why is Rhaenyra still reluctant to kill? Like, why is Otto deserved it, like, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think any of that is untrue. Like, I don't think she felt morally like that he didn't deserve to die. It's just that there's a difference between deciding that someone needs to die and actually killing them.
And giving them a trial.
Hold on.
Harry, finish your point. Finish your point. This is the first time what?
This is the first time the character has killed anyone. And I think that I wouldn't expect that to have gone any differently. So,
and I want to flag real quick. I used the wrong pronouns just now when I was talking about Emma D'Arcy. They use they them pronouns. That's my fault because she is a female character, and I always think of her think of them in that way. Go ahead, Cam. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, adding on to that point, I also feel like on an emotional level, no matter what he did as part of Rhaenyra getting usurped, as part of the whole green conspiracy, I do think there's a degree to which Otto probably still reminds Rhaenyra a little bit of her father. And I do think, you know, when all said and done, even though she sees Otto as someone who ultimately exploited and manipulated Viserys, I do think that she was thinking of her father in that moment. And she was thinking of how even with everything that happened, Viserys did see Otto as a very steady and reliable and supportive, not only hand, but friend to him. And I feel like that was part of the psychology of that scene.
Let me ask you guys this about Otto. So I was going to save the ending stuff for later, but let's talk about the ending now. Then I want to go back and talk about each character and specifically the Battle of the Gullet and address some of the complaints we had last week. So with Otto Hightower, yeah, I've pointed out in breakdowns in the past, and Harry, you have in your breakdowns, this is a guy who is from the family that traditionally had power in Westeros, the Hightowers, Old Town. That was the seat of power, of knowledge. And then when Aegon landed and conquered the Seven Kingdoms or Nine Kingdoms, depending on who you're talking to, or actually Six Kingdoms because he didn't conquer Dorne, whatever. When he did that, he shifted power away from Old Town and away from the Hightowers. And Otto Hightower is the second son who was set to not inherit land or title. So he definitely is trying to put his grandson, he pushed his granddaughter toward Viserys in order to, you know, put his family line on the throne and maybe even motivated in a way to outshine his older brother. However, do you think there's more to him than that? Like, do you genuinely think that he believed a woman for a queen would thrust the realm into war? Did he always think that he was doing the right thing, not just for his family, but for the kingdom? Harry, go
ahead. I can speak to this. I genuinely do believe that Otto believed to some degree that Rhaenyra being crowned queen would plunge the realm into war. And I don't even necessarily think that he is wrong entirely about that. I think it could have been different. It could have gone differently if everyone on that small council had actually supported her, as opposed to constantly undermining and plotting to usurp her. But I do think there were always going to be people who, Westeros is a very patriarchal society, and changing that is always going to create conflict. On the other hand, though, Otto definitely also wanted his grandson to be the king. So yeah, it's not like it was 100% selfless. I think there's a bit of both. He's a complicated character and another excellent performance. I'll miss seeing that character.
Just to hop on that real quick. I think that two things. Number one, if there's one thing George R. R. Martin loves in Ice and Fire, it's self-fulfilling prophecies. You see this with Cersei's prophecy. You see this with how some people interpret the prince who was promised. George loves making prophecies and allowing them to fulfill themselves. And I think one of those is a woman cannot be the queen of Westeros. I think there's this idea that the Civil War happened because everybody was telling each other that a woman could not rule Westeros. And it's like, okay, yeah, well, that's true if you say it. Like, if you all choose to not let a woman rule Westeros, but if all of you had come together and accepted that Rhaenyra would be the queen, it would have gone fine. It was all of you manufacturing this issue. And not to get too political, but I feel like that's the case with certain women and marginalized groups in politics too. People will say, oh, a woman can never be president. Oh, a person of this specific race or background can't be president. And it's like, yeah, well, if you keep saying that over and over again, it's true. But what if you just said, maybe a woman can be president, you know? So I think that there's a lot of self-fulfilling prophecy stuff there. With Otto Hightower, there's this very common character in Ice and Fire, which is like the scheming second son or the scheming person who came from a sort of humble background, like Littlefinger, for example. Littlefinger inherited like a small little tower with a couple of rooms somewhere off in the Vale nobody cares about. And he schemes his way up to the top and uses power in this very specific way. And in old George R. R. Martin blog posts, he talked about how traumatized he was by JFK's death. He was from a family that really admired the Kennedys. John F. Kennedy was like a political hero of his. And if you think of George R. Martin, where one of the fundamental traumas of his young life was seeing Kennedy get assassinated, then you think of Jace, who would have been a promising king, a young guy, a handsome guy, really liked. You think of Baelor Breakspear in 97. This young guy who was about to be the king that might have just changed everything for the better, but died too soon, too tragically. You think of Robb Stark.
Poor Joffrey, who was cut down way too soon.
Yeah, exactly. Robb Stark, Baelor Breakspear, a lot of the Targaryen sons, if you're reading Fire and Blood, generally speaking, if it seems like one of them is going to be good, that means they are going to suffer.
Rhaegar.
So, well, depending on your interpretation of Rhaegar, you know, that's so.
I forgot who I was talking to. Never mind. I think going down that road.
Otto Hightower a little bit is Lyndon B. Johnson. I think of him as somebody.
That's a great analogy. That's fantastic.
You know what I'm saying? I think George thinks a lot about that stuff. I think he thinks a lot about
because Lyndon Johnson was somebody who, oh God, you've said it now. Lyndon Johnson was somebody who, you know, wanted the presidency his entire career. He knew everyone in the Senate. He knew he could make things happen. He had a New Deal like list of priorities. And he's kind of like Otto Hightower, the most experienced guy who wouldn't have been anybody's first choice.
And that is my
opinion. I love that. That is a great point. And I'm a big fan of that. We just had a comment. Let me find it real quick to make sure I get the wording right. Even in the Kingsguard, misogyny runs rampant. From Greeky told us that. That is such a good point. Was it Duskendale? He was the knight who, maybe ancestor or distant relative of Duncan of Duskendale, who locked her in her room. And even Jace said to her in the previous episode, well, it's your life or hers because you're going to keep her safe by disobeying her. Not to keep bringing this up, but would they have ever locked a king in a room like that who was of age? You know, absolutely not. So I thought that was an interesting point too. Thank you for the comment.
And before the comments get to us, it's Sir Laurent Marbrand was that.
Thank you so much. What did Duskendale do? Was he the one who was with the Greens in the episode?
Sir Stefan Darklyn was last season, the ancestral seat of Duskendale, but I forget in what way it's because Aegon and Laerys were talking about going there that we brought up Duskendale.
Got it. But that's right. Thank you so much. I was wrong about that.
By the way, I just wanted to mention, just before we get away from the Marbrand thing and to touch on some of the other things, I thought it was very interesting watching the episode a second time, knowing that Rhaenyra is having trouble chopping off Otto Hightower's head, to see how she reacts to Marbrand, who gets down as like, chop off my head. And she's immediately kind of coming up with excuses and reasons not to do that. And then when she's walking out, she's like, have him choose how he wants to die. She's outsourcing it to him, and then ultimately is confronted. I really read into it, since we have never seen her kill anything except for a wild boar on this show, that it was, like you were saying, Harriet, killing that father figure, but also just like the act of killing, like one-on-one killing is something she has never done. And now she is going to have to make those decisions all the time, every single day. She's been able to put off as this faraway thing of, yes, I want to be queen, but it's over there. And now it's right here. And it comes through. And now I'm getting like, I'm just sort of meandering, but I just wanted to mention, since we haven't mentioned, I thought the direction and writing on this episode as well was phenomenal. And particularly just those shots that are simultaneously so obvious, but also so beautiful, of Rhaenyra walking from the puddle of blood, leaving her bloody footprints leading up to the throne.
And the reflection.
Seeing her sit on the throne and the reflection of the blood, like chef's kiss. Beautifully, beautifully done. And I think her Emma Darcy's, their performance would not have worked the same way without having a director so good in the chair, making sure that that all came through.
I want to throw this out there too. In our breakdown, sorry, Harriet, we didn't really draw parallels between that boar episode, but it would be interesting to go back and watch that, because that was the episode where Otto really started pushing for Viserys to name Aegon the heir, and where Rhaenyra first shows, you know, she, for one thing, goes off on a jaunt with Criston Cole that basically lays the groundwork for all of this, but it's also where she demonstrates like, yeah, I'm a gentle person, but motherfucker, push me and see what happens, because she really takes that boar out and walks into camp with it when the men couldn't find the vaunted white stag. The woman out by herself killed a boar. It might be interesting to see how that episode is a microcosm of the war that followed. Sorry, Harry, go ahead.
Actually, my point was related in that I saw people drawing comparisons, which I hadn't thought of, between the fact that it took Viserys 2 strikes to kill the deer that they caught in that episode. It's Rhaenyra was struggling in a similar way.
That's right. Viserys the Peaceful. So she was trying to be like her dad.
Really goes to show how sharp Valyrian steel is. Because if you recall correctly, Theon Greyjoy, back in season 2 of Game of Thrones, when he was beheading, I think it was Maester Luwyn, Winterfell, after he took Winterfell, he had a regular sword, and it took him like 8 to 10 hacks to behead this guy. And Rhaenyra, who I watched the scene twice just to be sure, didn't look like Rhaenyra was even putting that much of her weight into it. It seemed like she was sort of passively doing the beheading. 2 strokes by the standard of what I understand medieval beheading to be, pretty impressive for, was it Dark Sister?
Maybe she missed her calling.
Yes.
No, actually, it was Jace's sword, wasn't it, that she took? Or was Jace's sword not Valerian's steel?
It's Daemon's.
I think okay. She was
Daemon.
This she used for the beheading, sword. But she did take Jace's sword to King's Landing with her, which is a detail I learned from the making of that was after the episode, which is very cool. But Daemon gave her Dark Sister for that.
Yeah. One thing I will say that is just, again, one of those things that's sort of out of the showrunner's hands, and this is more the result of just the state of the industry, is Otto, you know, the Otto scene was really cool for me because I have all of the Ice and Fire books behind me and I'm obsessed with the series. For your average viewer hasn't seen Otto in like 4 years.
Since the Biden administration.
Yeah. Since the Biden administration. Yeah, we got some great scenes in episodes 1 and 2 of season 2 with Otto. There was a scene, the scene where Aegon sent him off and appointed Kristen Cole as the Hand. The acting from all of them was really, really good. And Otto was definitely part of some great scenes in early season 2. Then he disappears for most of season 2 and appears only in a brief shot where he's captured at the very end of the finale. I have a feeling that was something that they threw in last minute to remind the viewers that there was going to be more Otto once they found out that the final 2 episodes weren't going to air. So Otto gets brought out at the end of this episode, and it is a massive moment, and it is a massive conclusion to this one part of Rhaenyra's story, and frankly, this one part of the history of King's Landing. But your average viewer hasn't spent a substantive amount of time with Otto in so long that I feel like the people who recently binged seasons 1 and 2 to remember what was going on before season 3 started probably had a little bit better an experience with that scene than someone who saw it. Right. That's like, that's must be Allison's dad. The guy who played the lizard.
Oh, and that's what I mostly know him from. And also his great cameo in Venom 3 that totally made sense. Olivia Davies just left us a comment, reminded us that Theon killed Sir Roderick and didn't kill Maester Luwin.
Who killed Maester Luwin?
Himself. I don't know, somebody. Or maybe they're wrong, and I don't know. I'm just saying that's a comment.
No. I think it was, yeah, Roderick Castle, Jory Castle's father.
Yeah, because Maester Luwin is still alive when the
Ramsay takes over.
Arrive.
Got it.
Okay, want to quickly bring this up, guys. I don't know if you've seen this yet. If you watch our breakdowns, you've heard me talk about it. I love this freaking shirt. This is the Dance of the Dragons tour shirt. It's got dragons on the front. It's got Seven Kingdoms tour at the bottom and on the back. This absolutely amazing list of all of the different battles in the Game of Thrones font. I love this shirt. Mine's in the mail. I can't wait to show it to you guys in person. And we've got a couple other new shirts here I want to show off. They're not a big deal in the show yet, but trust me, the Winter Wolves are some of the coolest Starks or coolest characters in Game of Thrones. So this is a tribute to the Winter Wolves. We Came to Die shirt comes in multiple colors. And then one more we're showing for the first time in a live stream, Dunkin' Egg. I really wish we would have thought of this one when Night of the Seven Kingdoms was on. It's got the elm tree with the star above it, and links for those and more are down below. Thank you very much. I want to bring up, let's just go through some of the characters and talk about the fallout from the battle. So last week, Alex, you brought up, you couldn't really tell who was winning the battle. The sails were the same color. And I brought that into this episode. I was thinking about it and about how these people, the creators of the show, would know how to stage whether or not, you know, a battle was being won by one side. But I don't think the battle was about that. I think it was supposed to be personal stakes. And now I'm thinking that this episode was supposed to be a mystery until we found out. Was that your read on it? And do you think it was successful?
I don't know if I necessarily read it as a mystery so much as I changed my opinion, at least in this episode, that it was more about nobody really won, because I think that was kind of the theme. I mean, that's the theme of Game of Thrones in a certain sense, but like certainly
Dragons,
this episode, like Rhaenyra winning the throne, but sort of potentially losing everything in that final moment with Alicent, you work backwards from there. Everything comes out of that. Nobody is winning at any point, and that's what you get from just seeing the wreckage and the gullet. There's no winners or losers there. You have, I think, unless I'm wrong, it was the Triarchy. Were they fleeing on shore at the beginning there and then getting cut down because to the point that we're getting at, like, as a more casual viewer, it wasn't entirely clear who anybody was, because they're not like, we're the Triarchy, we got to get out of here. You know, nobody's, and I'm glad they didn't. But it was more about like, this is chaos and everybody is running off, trying to get away, trying to survive. It's the same thing that happens on that scene with Aegon and Larys on the road, where it's just two armies coming at each other and they're doing their semi-comedy thing in the middle there, just trying to scurry off and escape. So this is a long way around to saying that, like, I didn't need that as much in this episode because we did focus it on the personal. In the middle of the wreckage of the Battle of the Gullet, we honed in on Alyn and Bela and what was going on with them, which I thought mm-hmm. was great versus what I saw in the previous episode. You got those really personal relationships. They were talking about Corlys. They're looking for Corlys. I wish it was a little harder to find him versus he was just kind of hanging on a rock, but that's one tiny quibble in an otherwise great episode.
Big guy, big white hair. Dragon spot.
One issue that I kind of have with this show, I don't know how I'd fix it. There's a couple of things where I'd be like, here's what I would do. This one, I don't know. I feel like on this show specifically, in a way that was not true of Game of Thrones, I sort of struggle to remember why Harrenhal is so important for them to hold. I feel like the script does not go out of its way to remind us that much. Like, why does this big black castle that constantly seems empty and burnt out, why is this such a centerpiece for this war? And I understand, as somebody reads these books, you know, the placement of Harrenhal, the size of Harrenhal, how difficult it is to take. I get that. But if I were a casual viewer, I would just be like, why is everybody obsessing over the black spooky castle? I'm very nervous that some of the leaks are true, and I'm not going to spoil anything in the leaks, but just based on what I saw in this episode, I'm very nervous that we're going to get an Aemond plot this season that is pretty much a retread of what happened with Daemon last season, where he was having trippy dreams in Harrenhal. Well, what's her name?
I don't know. Am I the only one who kind of wants to see what his dreams are and if they're different? And that's the next thing I was going to bring up with Daemon.
It's more incest. It's like he already kissed Alicent last week.
Yeah.
Like, and there was so
much. Maybe we can make it go further this time. I don't know. Maybe, like, I don't know. Like, maybe, maybe as we broke the seal, we can do something else with it. I don't know.
That's Ryan's take on House of the Dragon. We need more incest.
Yeah, I'm from Southern Ohio. I don't know. So, look, Daemon, in this episode, you know, we saw him humbled last season. And I personally am of the mind, I love all the Daemon shit last season. I love seeing this, like, spoiled brat of a prince get humbled in different ways and learn how hard it is to rule, how hard it is to be political. And then seeing what Viserys saw, or at least some version of Aegon's dream, and understanding the future, and then understanding he is a very small part of this larger puzzle. That was a great arc. And then in this episode, I do love, though, that he's not, you know, coming in like Gandalf the White, totally changed. He's still such an arrogant prick. Like, the way he treats, and no spoilers for the books, but the way he treats the dragon seeds and Alice is like, dude, this woman saved your ass. Like, you would be nothing without her. And you won't even lie to her right now and say, well, yeah, I'll talk, see if I can get you a castle. I don't know. Like, you never know. Maybe we got a female queen now, you know, maybe we can do something for you. And then I just, on the other hand, and I want everybody's thoughts on Daemon in this episode, it's interesting to see that he's the one now who is talking to Rhaenyra and saying, remember the prophecy. Remember the real reason you're doing this. Because Daemon used to be the person who pursued power for the sake of power. And now he's the one who has a higher calling. I'll talk about Daemon all day. I love this character. What do you guys think?
I agree with you. I thought he was great in this episode. And there's really complicated work going on from Matt Smith, because it does hone down to really personal, petty stuff, like what he does with, oh my gosh, I'm Miseria, where obviously they have like a very deep history going on there, and he kind of can't let go of it until he does. The way that scene was staged with him going back on old pettiness, her pushing back on him, and ultimately them just sitting down on the bench, I thought was really nicely, a nice way of saying that, yeah, they're not going to let go of this stuff, but ultimately they are both there for Rhaenyra and making sure Rhaenyra gets what she needs to get. And I thought that was a nice way of putting it. It allows them to be human, fleshed out, rounded out characters in the middle of these very big stakes. And then moving into what you're talking about, Ryan, I thought that next scene with Rhaenyra bereft over the death of Jace, sobbing on her bed, Daemon sort of slow playing it, getting into being like, telling her what happened, saying that she needs to step up, she needs to go with Allison's plan, and then ultimately pivoting to, it's the fate of the world. It's bigger than us. So I think there's a level he understands that, but he also can't turn off being a total a-hole at any point also.
Harriet, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that little smirk when he walks past Miss Arya when they're leaving is just like the epitome of that character. And yeah, I loved that interaction between Daemon and Miss Arya, like that power play going on there. And I really hope that Rhaenyra kissing Miss Arya last season wasn't a one-off. I hope we get some more resolution of that plot line. Not just because I would like to see it, but I think that I hope that Aemon's plotline isn't a complete retreading of Daemon's, just because I want them to do something different. But I would like to see how Aemon's character could undergo some kind of transformation, because he has been a very static character, and mm-hmm. I would be interested to see what they do with him.
So back to that, Alice, right, last season we were like, well, what does she want? She must be a green seer, and she's trying to protect the world from the ice zombies. In this episode, we find out, yes, and a castle, please. I wonder, because that makes me think, okay, well, she was doing that for Daemon to stop the thing, right? Maybe Daemon's key to this. Maybe Rhaenyra's key to this. And we've seen Game of Thrones. We know Rhaenyra's efforts and Aegon's. And it doesn't matter, like in the grand scheme of things. The Targaryen dynasty falls in a couple hundred years or so. So I wonder if then she can use, if that would be her motivation for doing something similar with Aemon to controlling him, because she knows she exists at this time and place, depending on how old she is, which is up for debate. And she knows the Long Night's going to happen or not happen. It's got nothing to do with her. And she just wants a place to put her feet up and keep warm. Cam, what do you think?
I mean, I don't know. I think that with prophecy, the showrunners are probably going to take the chance to engage with the stuff that's more from the World of Ice and Fire world book than it is from the main Ice and Fire series and from the Fire and Blood book. Spoiler alert, you don't need to flash the sign again, but spoiler alert, there are photos that have been taken on set of the Green Men, who are characters.
They were in episode one.
The Green Men?
Yeah.
Yeah, they flashed. Harry, weren't they the antler guys, right?
Yeah, we yep. saw for a moment.
So spoiler alert for something that Cameron didn't know.
Okay, yeah. Well, hypothetically, if we see them again, they're characters who are just maybe the most mysterious things in the whole series, and that includes the Shadowlands beyond Ashai, which are kind of famous for being this thing that George left so vague because he wanted to toy around with it and then just never got to it. And now, because he wrote a million pages of Daenerys Targaryen and Meereen, we're probably never going to get to see it. But the Green Men are these ancient beings in Westeros that seem to have ties to the Children of the Forest and the First Men, and potentially the Others or the White Walkers. And they're on the Isle of Faces, which is also one of the most mysterious locations mm-hmm. in the series. I personally theorize that the Isle of Faces is where the final book is totally going to come out of the Ice and Fire series is going to culminate. I think that Bran is going to go to the Isle of Faces to make a new pact with the White Walkers. I don't think that the battle with the White Walkers ends in some giant war. I think that it ends in a pact, because George R. R. Martin is a hippie and he doesn't think war is the answer to anything. But I think if you have a season with Aemon at Harrenhal, and Harrenhal is right next to the Isle of Faces, it's right on the God's Eye, and you have this mm-hmm. magic element and you need something for him to do, because that actor just, like I say about everybody, he just chews up his screen time. He's so captivating. I think you might want to get into some of that lore and have a little bit of fun with it, because what has already been prophesized is the end to both Daemon and Aemond is not going to happen until season four. They're not going to do that this year. So what are we going to do with Aemon this year? Because in the book, there isn't really much that he actually does between him taking Harrenhal and his character's ultimate demise. So what are we going to give him for the next several episodes? And the answer is visions and magic stuff. And I think that we might see some ties to the Green Men. I honestly think we might see some things that people like Elio and Linda, George's assistants and editors and stuff, some things that they know about Ice and Fire that the books haven't necessarily.
Oh, interesting.
I think that that's
even though it looks like it's a retread and we'd be doing the same thing again, I personally am really intrigued. I like when we get into the deep magic. Question for, I guess, everybody here. At this point in history, there is a three-eyed raven. It's just not Brendan Rivers, right? Because isn't that like a title that passes from person to person?
Depends on what you're citing. Because as far as we know in the books, as far as we know in the books, Brendan Rivers, I mean, he hasn't even specified that he's Brendan Rivers, by the way. He's just said, my mother named me Brendan, and we're pretty sure he's Brendan Rivers. But Blood Raven, as far as we know, is the only person who is assumed to be the Three-Eyed Crow. But not to get into Ice and Fire fan theory territory, I will say when Bran asks him, are you the Three-Eyed Crow? Or in the show, it's called the Three-Eyed Raven. When Bran asks him, are you the Three-Eyed Crow? He goes, Crow? So Blood Raven, while he's attached to the Weirwood tree, while he's the Three-Eyed Crow, he doesn't know what Bran is talking about when Bran says Three-Eyed Crow. So is the Three-Eyed Crow some other entity, or is it just the manifestation? Is it just the manifestation of Blood Raven in Bran's dreams? And Blood Raven doesn't really know how he appears in Bran's dreams. But again, Bran didn't say, are you the Three-Eyed Crow? And Blood Raven said, yes, it was me all along. He was like, I don't really know what you're talking about. My name is Brendan. So there's a lot of questions that can be answered that I don't necessarily think we might ever get answers to. And I think that if you're going to have a season of a character so captivating as Aemond walking around Harrenhal, you might be able to get into a little bit of the lore just to throw the bones, just to throw the fans a little bit of a bone.
And to not repeat beats from the first episode too.
There's one other aspect, and I might be way off base about this because it's based on just how he crawled towards Alice. It was like, he's probably found another mommy figure, right? Like that's what he's obsessed with. And I don't know, Alice wants Harrenhal so badly for whatever reason it is, long-term or short-term, that I feel like we're going to get a little something there as well.
I hope it turns out that Alice doesn't actually, you know, because the thing about Alice is, and you know, Harry, you talked about this in your script last night, she could be really old. She could be like tied to the children of the forest and old gods, or she could not be. Like it's left ambiguous on purpose. And I really hope that she's like super duper old and is tied to the old magic. And part of the reason she wants Harrenhal is because, you know, they cut down weirwood trees to build it. And it's like, it would be a completion to all of the injustice done to the green seers of the past. That's what I'm hoping for. I also got some questions I want to ask you guys about Alicent and her arc in this. But first, let's just really quickly, I want to revisit Rhaena and Sheepstealer. Rhaena is the one who takes her, right? I always get the two twins confused.
Yes.
That's an interesting story. So the Lady of the Vale basically turned her away, said, I don't want you. And in the book, it's not Rhaena, it's Nettles. And I don't think the book had Nettles being responsible for the death of Jace. So they're doing something different here. It seems like on paper, they're leaving her with no choice and she'll have to go to the Greens. What do you guys think?
I don't know if I think that she's going to the Greens because of this. I mean, it seems like based on where we left her in this episode, she's just going to hang out in the Vale, which I think, you know, Nettles spends a lot of time kind of hanging out in the wilderness, and I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of give that arc to Rhaena. I don't think we're going to see her go over to the Greens, though. I don't think that as a character, like, she would ever turn on her sister, but... but who knows?
Can I just say that sounds awesome? Because first of all, I barely remember anything about her as a character. I mean, they really haven't given her that much to chew on. Like, I know that she is the character they're subbing in for Nettles, and is of, you know, the descent of old Valyria. That's pretty much all I've got on her. In the book, there's just all these characters. They can only be so fleshed out. Her going to the Greens, I'd be like, okay, I forgive you guys for cutting Nettles. Nettles is the coolest character in the Dance of the Dragons. She is, in my opinion, the most important part of the dance because I don't think she has any dragon blood in her. I think she's just a really smart.
I think we talked last week. There is a fan theory that she's Daemon's bastard daughter when he lived in the Vale.
And I hope that's not true because
I personally like the idea that she tamed the dragon better. Like that she just brought the dragon sheep
Again, that makes the Valyrian supremacy thing one of those self-fulfilling prophecies that George loves so much. But I don't think George entirely knows his opinion on Valyrian supremacy because George R. R. Martin as an individual seems to like loathe the concept of genetic supremacy, but also seems to think that Valyrians are a little bit better.
It's blood magic. I think what he also shows is the same thing that makes them strong. The blood, the tie to the dragons is also the same thing that they're undoing because they're so incredibly inbred that they all go insane, no matter how sweet they seemed when they were 13 years old.
Yeah. What I was going to say was like, if Sheepstealer goes to the Greens, that will fix what I consider to be a bunch of logical issues with the story, because even with Vhagar, the Black Faction has so many dragons at this point that it takes a lot of contrivances in Fire and Blood, by the way, for the Black Faction to just not obliterate the Green Faction immediately. I mean, like, yes, Vhagar is formidable. I'm not downplaying that at all. If you just send Syrax, or in like the Valyrian pronunciation that Rhaenyra uses, like Syrax, if you just send Syrax and Meraxes, or Caraxes, which one is Daemon's?
Caraxes.
The blood worm, right? If you send them to team up against Vhagar, send one of them for Vhagar's big fat neck, Vhagar's done. Like it requires a lot of timing and placement for this.
Vhagar's slow,
and also Vermithor is slow. Vermithor is a huge.
No, I mean, I think that's why the thing with the dragon seeds, they're doing work to move them around the board a little bit, like, go wait here. Well, we thought maybe we should move because they're dumbasses. Exactly. Hugh Hammer, I think, I'm waiting for Hugh Hammer to be as cool as he is in the book. But Ulf is definitely what I thought he would be like. He's just a huge dumbass. Armand gave us £2, said, can't stick around for long. You're sick and just saying hi. We hope you feel better. Aww. Armand.
I was just going to say, like, would love for another dragon to go team up with the Greens because the Greens have Vhagar and they've got Tessarion, the blue dragon who we're going to meet, who I think we saw in a cage. And then you've got Sunfire, who we're not entirely sure what Sunfire's circumstances are right now, but, things are the Greens don't have that many dragons, and the Black Faction has so many dragons that putting Sheepstealer on the Green side would at least give a little bit more of a dynamic to that. But I don't know. I don't think it's going to happen. It's just the thing about I love Nettles going into the mountains and becoming a mountain witch, because when you're reading Fire and Blood and you haven't heard from Nettles in a really long time, and like 200 pages after the last Nettles mention, you hearing word of a witch in the mountains, and suddenly everyone says, hey guys, it's Nettles and she's with Sheepstealer. That was one of the coolest parts of reading the entire book. I was like, this is awesome. But
it's also another chance to bring a commoner into the story, especially into a show that mostly focuses on, you know, wealthy Targaryen lords and highborn people.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, I don't completely remember the timeline. Maybe one of you guys will be able to help me with this. I'm pretty sure the Nettles appearing in the mountains is something that happens after the dance. And I don't remember.
That's correct.
I think it happens during the reign of the king who will be king after this is all over. And I don't think the show is going to end. I think the show maybe ends with that king's coronation. Other than that, a lot of the final maybe 50 to 100 pages of Fire and Blood, I don't think are going to make it into the show. Like, I think this show is telling the story of Rhaenyra and Aegon II, and Fire and Blood goes a little bit further than that. So I don't think the Sheep Stealers in the Mountains plot is going to happen, and therefore, if they send Sheep Stealer to the Greens, great.
I wonder if they're going to adjust the timeline a little bit and end the show with the last dragon dying. Just for to put a real button on it. I know they last, they persist for a while, but they don't grow any larger. But they I think need something at the end of the show to tell us, yeah, the age of the dragons is done. So let's get to Alicent real quick. So Alicent spends the episode trying to save her one good kid, Mother of the Year, Helena, and trying to protect her. And they're running around. Harriet, in your Easter egg video, you did a great job of mentioning that everybody recognizes them because Otto made them parade the body of her child throughout the streets of King's Landing. So they're caught immediately. And then Alicent goes in that throne room and she sees that her father is dead. She doesn't necessarily know that Rhaenyra did it, but she sees that he is dead. I wonder in that moment how much love she had for her father, how betrayed she felt by Rhaenyra, or if she felt betrayed at all. And if she thinks in that moment, oh, I didn't expect this, I've made the wrong decision, because she was ready for Rhaenyra to kill her kid. You think that her dickhead dad that set her up to be a sex slave for decades is where she draws the line? Like, what's everybody's thoughts on it? Harry, what do you think?
I mean, I do think that's kind of a line for her, because that was not the deal that they made. Like, Alicent has been bending over backwards to set everything up. And you could argue that she is also, like, reneged on her part of the deal because Aegon isn't there, although that's not her fault.
True.
But she, it was very, very difficult for her to make that decision to say, yeah, you can kill Aegon and come take over. Like, I think Olivia Cooke's acting in that scene is phenomenal also. But I think she does have love for her father. I mean, I don't think that Otto was a good dad. but I think the scene, like, where Otto is banished from King's Landing in season one, and Alicent is left behind crying, and he says to her, "You chose Rhaenyra." And this is an echo of that exact thing. She chose Rhaenyra and it ended with her father's death. And I think she is afraid, like, all the throughout the whole episode, she's been saying to everyone, if Rhaenyra comes in and becomes queen, we can end this war without further bloodshed. It will be peace. No more death. And I think the death that she was resigned to was Aegon's. I do not think she was resigned to seeing her father beheaded when she didn't even know he was there. So that's another thing. But I think, you know, we can argue all day whether or not she's actually justified to feel betrayed by that. But ultimately, like, emotion doesn't follow 100% logical reason, and I think she's pretty upset about this.
I just want to add on to that, and I think those are all great points, just very briefly, but just in terms of the acting, the pairing of a silent Olivia Cooke reaction shot where she goes through maybe five different emotions, followed up by Emma Darcy also going through five different emotions, I thought was great, not just for showcasing these two incredible actors, but also recentering the show. We have a seismic change at the end here.
Absolutely.
To everything that has gone on in the previous episodes, to say, nope, this show is still about Rhaenyra and Alicent and their relationship with each other, bigger than prophecy, bigger than all these deaths, bigger than anything else. Are they ever going to be able to find common ground again? That's the thing coming out of this episode that I am most excited to see.
They just wanted to just run around. Anybody's phone ringing on the other end there?
That was me.
They just wanted to fly around. It's okay. They wanted to fly around just being girlfriends and having dragon adventures, man. Like, it just sucks. Like, every time I see these two on screen, it reminds me of a really good play I recently saw where I'm just like,
Alicent in particular, I think, who I think we all agree has never done anything wrong in her entire life. She's a precious
perfect. She's
role.
Without spot.
Exactly. Yeah. But she works so hard this episode to keep things on track. She puts everything on the line.
Yeah.
And like Harriet was saying, to then come in and be like, not only captured when she was trying to get out of town and keep her daughter safe, but also to be like, oh, my father is dead and his blood is all over the floor. That's such a punch in the gut for her. And Olivia Cooke plays it so well.
You know,
and the plan to leave was so silly, too. I mean,
Yes.
Why not just try? If you're going to trust Rhaenyra for everything else, you think she's going to kill you? I don't know. Sorry, Cam, go ahead.
I promise you, I literally swear on my life, I'm not going to bring up A Feast for Crows again. I've brought up A Feast for Crows probably in the last 4 Screen Crush appearances I made. I'm not going to do it. But Allison is a really interesting character in season 2 because she had these long, boring, meandering scenes, which I really liked. And I thought that they were some of the best scenes in the season, where she's sitting around in the consequences of her own actions. Because, you know, Allison is one of these characters. And they make a point to show you this and how much symbolism she uses with the 7-pointed star, how often she's wearing that necklace that represents the faith. Allison is sort of that character that reminds us that one of the most vital partners in perpetuating misogyny is the women who help out to do it. And Allison is that woman. You know, she's the woman who works for the boss at the company where the boss is sexually harassing one of the employees and sends his female assistant to go cover it up, intimidate the victim, those things. Like, it's something we see in politics all the time. Like, Allison has been someone knowingly and unknowingly perpetuating all of the things that the show is about. And in season 2, watching just the disaster that came from the coronation of Aegon II, she got to live in those consequences. And something that I'm very afraid of with the show, and I say this as an Allison fan, is that the writers are just going to get obsessed with humiliating her. I think that the scene where she was attacked by somebody who had the intent of committing sexual violence, it didn't end up going through, but it just made me think that the writers might be entering this pattern of behavior where they're like, oh, we're going to use Allison as sort of this dummy to beat up for all of the grievances that people have with the green cause. And we're just going to constantly put Allison through this endless torture, which is just something we've been seeing with her, you know, again, throughout season 2 as well. So now she's finally done this thing and made a point to help support the coronation of Rhaenyra, or not the coronation, she's the Rhaenyra taking King's Landing. I'm like, are they going to make us sit here and watch Allison just get humiliated over and over again? Or is she going to play some different role? So I'm hoping we get something.
Harry, in your video, you made a good point. You really spoke to that scene really well. You might got an answer for that?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that scene because I've seen a lot of critiques of it this morning after the episode.
And in the chat right now, too.
And in the chat right now, which I understand a lot of those criticisms. But at the same time, I actually really like that scene for the plot and for Allison's character. I think this is the first time that Allison has ever tried to say no to sex. She's been a victim of sexual violence her entire life. And I think seeing her viciously fight back in that moment was really cathartic as a character choice. I mean, the scene is horrifying, obviously. But I think it does matter that was her reaction, was that finally, like, the clawing and the attacking with the statuette and everything. And also, I think this might be my more hot take about it. I think that Lord Jasper in that scene is meant to be a stand-in for some of the people who really hate Alicent. I think
interesting.
The things that he says at the beginning of that scene, like, oh, you've been worming your way up in court your whole life, like basically accusing her of, like, seducing Viserys, which is a complaint that people have about Alicent that I could not disagree more with, but I won't go on that rant at this moment. Basically accusing her of being like a scheming little seductress, which is like a very disingenuous,
not even remotely.
Have.
It's not even remotely a part of the show. I mean, the reason she hates Rhaenyra is because Rhaenyra got to do what she wants and she didn't. I don't know. I guess if you're not reading subtext into the show and you only like read recaps after, you could take that. I don't see where people get
it. It may be if you just hate women. But seeing like this, like basically the show almost, I felt like, was like, this is the character that you are, and you get your head cut off by the end of the episode. So
I'll also throw out there, and just to give like a little bit of a different view on it, though I agree with everything that you just said there, is without speaking about the explicit content and different ways that they could do it, I took this as yet another way where, oh, we're watching a franchise where everything goes wrong all the time. And just mm-hmm. when the characters are about to have a victory, it's snatched away from him. Throughout mm-hmm. this episode, as I mentioned earlier, we have multiple scenes where that happens, where instead they kind of win, like almost immediately. I mean, down to finding Corliss very quickly on the rocks, where you would expect that to stretch out for episodes and episodes. He'd end up in a horrible circumstance. Instead, they find him, and he's like walking around and pretty much find the next scene. Same thing with this Allison scene, where you expect her to be assaulted based on everything we've watched for, what is it, 15 years or so at this point? Or you would expect Orwell to come in and side with Jasper Wilde and things get horribly wrong and Allison just thrown in prison or whatever else. Instead, Orwell comes in at the right time, says the truth the way that he sees it, and she's free to go. So we get this entire episode, same as Rhaenyra and Daemon just walking into King's Landing, walking into the Red Keep with barely anybody standing against them most of the time. That's something that never happens. So that, to me, while I might not, you know, I'm not like, wee, this is a fun scene to watch or anything, but it's thrilling to watch, like, oh, things are turning out right for our folks right up until they don't at the end and it twists, and obviously things are going to go horribly wrong for the next six episodes or so. But that to me felt like that was the place there to show us Alicent in the situation where we've seen her in so many times before. And this time it kind of goes right. And she's the main man, as that shirt says. Is that what
was yeah, that was an accident. I'm sorry about that. I was hoping it was accidentally a Game of Thrones shirt, but I literally minimized the screen and hit the wrong.
They're all bastards. That's what I would say.
But yeah, but they did a great job there of like rope-a-doping you. Of you thinking, assuming it's so much fun because you haven't read the book to hear your reaction when they storm the Red Keep because I you know we all knew the three of us knew what was going to happen so getting to hear that it was even suspenseful wasn't something that would really cross my mind because when you read the book it's like and then they went into the you know like it just tells you what happened it doesn't say like they went down a hallway there's this it's like it's a maester recounting stuff that a priest and a dwarf said you know like it's not presented in a dramatic way you have to like read the drama from the situation. Guys, we got to wrap it up there. Oh, go ahead. Oh, no, we got a super chat, too. Go ahead, Harriet.
I was just saying I always watch it with two friends who have not read the book, and they were both like, I'm so scared during that whole scene.
Oh, that's awesome. So. Yeah, I guess I do, too. I just didn't, you know, I don't measure the reactions that much. Okay, so the one who knocks, very cute, is gave us $5. And I like this a lot, said, are Laris and Aemon, the new Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, or what? Seriously, what's going on with them? Look, in the book, all I'll say is Aegon just disappears. He just goes away for a while, right? Because nobody knew where he was. And one thing I love about this series is finding out that Rhaenyra and Alicent had a deep friendship from childhood, from girlhood, and finding out where the hell he went when he disappeared. And just the fact that, like, you know, they're sniping at each other and he's mad at him and he doesn't see, he's a dumbass, so he doesn't see the bigger picture. And the way that you pointed out in the breakdown, Harriet, he snaps off the arrow, just stabs the guy from the Triarch because he's so frustrated and he's trying to own some control of the situation.
Thanks so much. You gotta go, Cam. All my love.
All right, Cam, you're fired. I'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
Oops. Wait. Oh. He took himself off. I fired Harriet at the same time. Sorry about that. Yeah, but no, they've been absolutely so much fun to pair together. Really good. Yeah,
they're
time.
Doing their like little like Three Stooges routine, and I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, it's like the road to King's Landing.
Exactly. They're the new Bing Crosby and Bob Hope is what's going on here.
I'm loving every second of it. All right, we gotta go. Oh, Alex, did the people on the phone ever get back to you?
What's going on? Yeah, they actually said I gotta get on Chop Chop. Again, not sure what that means, but
got it. Excellent. Thank you so much. You can find Alex on the Comic Book Club podcast. That is linked below. And of course, Harriet, her own channel is linked below. And you can find her stuff here on Screen Crush all the time. Harriet, love your videos. Love working with you. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Bye. And we want to hear from you guys. What did you think about the episode? Let us know your thoughts down in the comments below. And remember, Screen Crush members at our $5 tier get 15% off our merch store and all the really cool Game of Thrones merch we showed before. You can let us know what you think down in the comments or on our free to join Discord server, or follow me on Substack. That's always a big help. And if it's your first time here, make sure you subscribe and smash that bell for alerts. For Screen Crush,